You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast today. Gary Noesner was an FBI hostage negotiator for 23 years and spent 10 years as the Bureau's chief negotiator. His book, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, is legendary in the Bureau and among all the law enforcement officials that we've worked with over the last 2 years at Second City. You're going to love this conversation. Enjoy the pod. Gary Noesner, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great to be here with you.
There is a sentence in the preface of your book, Stalling for Time, that succinctly sets up the problem you faced early in your career at the FBI in this particular field. You write, quote, "In the early years of the profession, every negotiation seemed to involve two equally challenging components, managing the actual hostage situation and managing the leaders and colleagues captive to the entrenched law enforcement response to hostage events, which emphasized the use of force and viewed negotiators as do-gooder types who only got in the way of them doing their jobs," end quote. So I'm curious if in the early days of trying to push for your way of negotiating, that you ever thought it wasn't worth the fight?
No, because obviously in our field of endeavor, it's life and death. So, I mean, it's hard not to embrace the concept that anything you do to save a life is the preferred method. But no, I think that sentence you read is a really good reflection of what we faced. You know, law enforcement at all levels is a paramilitary organization. And sure, we have, you know, training and authority and uniforms and badges. We don't have uniforms in the FBI, but you get my point. And, you know, when we expect people to comply with what we tell them to do when we're enforcing the law, and when they don't, we're human beings. We get frustrated and we are quick to say, well, you tried to do this the nice way, and now I'm going to show you who's in charge. And we go to our physical card. And we're certainly seeing a lot of that currently, you know, with some of the stuff going on with the immigration, you know, raids and so forth. But, you know, I think we have to be smarter. We have to be wiser. We serve the public. I've always embraced and firmly believed in the concept that we should use no more force than is absolutely necessary. And the force that we ultimately may have to employ is based exclusively on the conduct and behavior of the perpetrator. In other words, we don't become violent because we can or we're able to. We do it because the actions of the person we're dealing with leave us no choice. And I think when we live up to that standard, the public supports us. And they readily see that, hey, you know, these guys were reasonable. They tried to get this person to cooperate. They were flexible and creative and, you know, tried to understand their problems and issues and treated them politely and professionally and genuinely. But this person just wasn't having any of it, whether it's drugs, alcohol, you know, enragement, whatever it might be. Ergo, his behavior, her behavior, usually his, forced law enforcement to take a more physical posture to resolve the situation. And I think, again, the public, I think, understands that. But it is quite common where police, through our individual frustrations, don't really like it when somebody thumbs their nose at our authority and defies our instructions and, you know, maybe calls us names or throw things at us, whatever. And, you know, police officers are human beings. And So that's a culture that to some extent continues, but certainly in my 30 years in the FBI, 23 as a negotiator, you know, we saw that certainly was the case. And, you know, you have to train police officers that, you know, you get more with honey than with vinegar, as they say, you know, and you have to learn to, you know, avoid these issues to the extent you can, these confrontations. If they occur, you need to have verbal skills to be able to diffuse them. You know, Kelly, it's funny. I tell this when I speak to law enforcement audiences, any police department in the country will expend a pretty significant amount of time on firearms training and physical fitness training and how to arrest somebody and you know, getting them to restrain and so forth. But we spend relatively little time on communication skills. And many departments spend almost zero time on that. And that may be the most powerful, important, and used tool that a police officer needs to have. You know, and I've always, I'm not against those other skill sets that are required, and certainly proficiency in firearms and learning how to arrest somebody safely. Those are key elements in what we have to do. But to not pay attention to our communication skills, giving us the ability to diffuse crisis situations. I'll give you one example, then I'll shut up and let me get to your questions. But many years ago when I was in the FBI, a small police department in Florida reached out to me and they said, you know, we've been looking at this active listening stuff that you've been teaching and we want to train our whole police force in these skill sets. And I said, I think that's a great idea. So I, you know, gave them some material and encouragement and so forth and so on. And I can't remember the reason, but I got contacted by them about a year after and they said, every police officer in our force has been trained. And you know what? Our SWAT call-outs have been reduced 75%. Now, what does that tell you? I mean, it tells you that now these first responding officers now had the skills to diffuse situations and to calm things down and to resolve them without us resorting to the use of force. And I think it's unfortunate that many departments certainly have embraced these concepts, but many don't. Every single FBI agent now gets trained in active listening skills. And that all started with our negotiation unit. And I think it's vital.
So it's interesting. One of our guests next week on the podcast is a woman named Caroline Fleck, who's a psychologist and a scientist, a professor. And she has a book on validation. And what she sort of indicates in the book is, she looks at DBT therapy, which is very common right now, and validation is part of it. But she thinks it's the most important part because across all these different mediums, whether it's couples therapy or working with family and kids, whether it's negotiations, the idea of simply validating the person across from you, you see them and you understand them, is the first step towards some sort of potential problem solving or reconciliation or what have you. And this is such a thing in improv because our whole concept around yes and is like, I'm going to affirm what you're saying and I'm going to build on it. And that's just the start. Doesn't mean that that's where it's going to end up and it could end up.
Right.
But if we start there, we've got a place to go to. And you know, it's not like you come out, you were a child of the 50s and 60s, but you weren't like a counterculture kid. Right. So, I mean, it's interesting that you were able and you wanted to join the force and all that. So I'm just sort of curious, where did you get that sort of instinct that something like listening could be so important?
Kelly, you're the first ones ever said I'm counterculture, you know, so I'm taken aback by that. Humorously.
Yes.
You know, I think how much is nurture, how much is nature? You know, I think my father was a big influence on me. He was very calm. I never saw my dad get upset. And, you know, he sort of had this innate ability to kind of diffuse tense situations. And he didn't have any kind of a critical job where those skills came into play, but just his normal social interaction. You know, my dad was that cool head that you always went to get a good idea on what to do or how to handle something. And I think I inherited some of that. And then part of it is I learned while doing this. You know, when I first became a negotiator, it was in the very early days of the specialty, the profession. And in those days, it was based almost exclusively on bargaining skills, you know, instrumental quid pro quo. Well, you know, Kelly, you want a hamburger? Well, you're going to have to let one of those hostages go. It was still successful in that it slowed things down. It had us in dialogue versus confrontation, physical confrontation. No, that was all positive. But, you know, when I got full time to the FBI Academy in 1990 to become one of, you know, at the time, two full time FBI negotiation instructors, 350 that we led around the country. But what we began to discover as we were teaching more and more around the country is that quid pro quo bargaining was not what police were doing at all. I mean, almost rarely. Those are hostage situations. I'm holding a hostage to get something I can't get. I'm threatening to harm them. You give me what I want, I'll give you the hostage. That's quid pro quo bargaining. But what police were facing, and we found that very few had ever handled what we would call a real hostage situation. They were handling crisis incidents. You know, people angry at their employer, having an argument with their spouse, abusing alcohol, drugs, having a fight with their neighbor over their fence line, you know, whatever it might be, people who tended to be pretty impulsive, people who angered quickly and were hard to calm down. And these were the folks that were engaging in behavior that brought them to the attention of the police. So you don't go up to somebody like that and say, hey, you know, I know you want to kill your neighbor, but how about a hamburger and, you know, call it a day. It's not what it's about. So we borrowed from Carl Rogers, you know, the famous psychotherapist, yeah. and used active listening skills, which, you know, we didn't invent them, but we adapted them pretty expansively for FBI and then police negotiators, because it armed us with some identifiable skills that negotiators could practice and master, and allowed you to do just what you set this whole question up on. It allowed us to stay in their frame of reference, to acknowledge that we hear what they have to say. When people are behaving badly, they're usually in a higher state of emotion. They're raising their voice and engaging in physical activities, all meant to get our attention and to tell us that something's irritating them, something's bothering them. And when we take the time to listen, acknowledge, demonstrate that we understand by repeating it back in our own words, not just saying, yeah, I hear you, I understand. No, I'm going to tell you what you just told me to validate to you that I heard everything you said and I understand what happened to you and how you feel about it. And when we do that, number one, it erases the need for them to continue to be demonstrative. Mm-hmm. And number two, it creates a relationship. Well, you're the first person that's finally taking the time to understand my point of view. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just saying I hear and understand what you're saying. And it's so simple, and yet not enough people use it, certainly outside of the negotiation realm. And, you know, when I first started teaching this stuff, you know, about 1990, I'd go to a big negotiation conference. There'd be like, you know, 200, 300 people. And I'd say, how many of you heard of active listening skills? And not a single hand would go up in the audience, not one. Mm-hmm. Now you go to any of the 24 negotiation conferences held annually around the country, and all 100% of the hands would go up, because everybody knows this is the baseline skill set that we teach to give us the tools to help people in crisis. And it's terribly effective. And it also works in hostage situations. I mean, people want to deal with people they like, respect, and feel are genuine and honest and trustworthy. You know, if I say, Kelly, you know, if you put your gun down and come out the back, the officer's there, you know, we're not going to throw you on the ground and embarrass you in front of your neighbors. You know, you'll be treated with dignity. And the Kellys of the world come out because they believe it when the negotiator says that. And why do they believe it? Because I've taken the time to demonstrate my sincerity and genuineness. It's, you know, when you look at it that way, it's so simple, but it's really not, is it?
No, it's hard. And I think when we first started communicating, we were just either we're going to or coming back from the conference in Baltimore. I think it was the 44th annual conference, which I think you helped start.
Yeah, I was very involved in the early days of it. I would say that, you know, I used to speak at it every year. I think I missed the very first one, but then I was in at the next dozen or something after that. And
it was really, I didn't know how we would be received in this environment, because every other environment had been kind of set up for this. It was a lot of people. But one of the improv exercises we had them do that got a great response is called Last Word, where it's just we have two people pair up, have a conversation. One rule, you have to start your response with the last word the other person said.
Hmm.
So it forces you to listen to the end of sentences.
Yeah.
And people sort of recognize why was that hard? Oh, because I'm not used to listening. I'm getting prepared to respond
right.
in a smart way because I don't. And what we know when we're improvising on stage is there is no script. We are the ones creating the script together. And the last few words might be crucial information for me to then build this thing and not look stupid in front of an audience. You know, and that's just not a way that we necessarily go about our lives in daily life. And so I was really, to your point, recognizing that wasn't something that maybe people understood or appreciated a long time ago, to have the vast majority of these people sort of say, yeah, that was really great, to me was terrific, because we're just a bunch of like jerks from a comedy theater in Chicago.
Well, a pretty famous one. But, you know, yeah. I would say that you're absolutely right when you say we tend as human beings to begin to process what we're going to say. And it takes us away from focusing sufficiently on listening to what the other person said. I like to explain this to maybe illustrate it to students that this is really a dance. This is a waltz. And the other guy's leading. Let them lead the dance. Mm. Let them take you on the dance floor where they want to. And that's just fine. And you'll go along with that. And if you embrace the concept that I'm letting them lead the discussion, it really removes you from the pressure of feeling you have to come up with some super creative line. And therefore, if that pressure is removed, you behave and come across more authentic, more sincere. You know, most of us, if we were talking to a dear friend on the phone that was going through a crisis, we would devote an inordinate amount of time trying to help them, to listen to them and to understand and to be a good friend and empathic. You know, well, that's what you need to do with a stranger that's in a crisis. You know, that same level of attentiveness will really win the day. And it's so easy when you've been doing this for a while, it becomes second nature, obviously. But for so many people, it's a hard concept to grasp because they're so uptight and acting unnatural because they're so pressuring themselves. They had performance anxiety over what am I going to say next? How am I going to respond? And the other thing I tell people is, you know what? Nothing you say is going to cause this person to harm themselves or someone else. I can't embed the idea. I can't say, Kelly, go kill your producer. You know, and right. It doesn't work that way. You know, but what I can do if I listen thoughtfully and acknowledge what you've said, you know, it makes you feel good that, yeah, this guy's listening. He's paying attention to me. He understands. You know, and I can ask open-ended questions. And if I get something a little wrong, well, you'll straighten me out. You know, well, Kelly, you know, you really dislike dealing with a law enforcement audience. You say, no, I didn't dislike it. It was just a new challenge for me. Okay, so I misunderstood or didn't get it right in my description of what I thought you said, but you then took the opportunity to correct me on it. And that's even more powerful for me. Fine. What did I lose? I lost nothing. I gained more precise information about what it is that's driving your behavior. So, I mean, if you look at it that way, I mean, I go into every negotiation expecting to be successful because I can control myself and I'm going to follow along with this other person. I'm not concerned about where the conversation's going. I'm not uptight. I got to get these 12 points in. And, you know, I'm just there for the ride to create the relationship first. And eventually in my former life, you'd get to a point where somebody would say, you know, after 2 hours, Gary, I just don't know how to get out of this. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. My ears perk up because now they're soliciting my advice. Mm-hmm. And I might say something like, well, it is a difficult situation you're in, but you know, I know that harming those people are really not going to make it any better. And, you know, killing your boss certainly isn't going to get you your job back. So why don't we talk about some way that we can work together to get the grievances that occurred addressed properly? But, you know, you're going to have to come out and there'll probably be some consequences for what happened. I'm not a judge. I'm not a jury. But I will be more than willing to say that hey, you were cooperative. You didn't hurt anyone. And, you know, we don't lie. We don't, you know, I shouldn't say we've never lied, but it's a rare thing. We try to avoid it at all costs, because once you're caught at that, then you're cooked. But, so that's how the process works. And, I would imagine that the improv, stuff is extraordinarily, helpful in helping people be creative and watch for those little, cues that help them to respond more effectively. Yeah. I would love to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. They get to practice. So one of the things that's been really interesting, is almost every one of these groups, we go on break, we start chatting, and they're like, have you read Gary's book? I mean, like, everyone has read your book. In reading it, I thought it was a really shrewd decision to start the book with a hostage incident that really tests this contradiction within the field that we've talked about. And in this case, I think it's Charlie Leaf had abducted his estranged former wife and their child and was held up in a farmhouse in the mountains of Virginia. Can you talk a bit about that case?
Yeah, I mean, it was a real challenging case. I got called out to a farmhouse in a remote area about, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours west of D.C. And a man had kidnapped his former common-law wife and their child, a little five-year-old, I believe, and drove them, kidnapped her. They had long since separated. He kidnapped her from her parents' house. They moved to, drove to Virginia, ran out of gas, ran out of money, started camping out in the woods, eventually broke into a farmhouse to wash their clothes and old farmhouse used by people as a part-time weekend getaway. Anyway, the FBI team located them in there and the negotiation ensued. And we ended up, he became very ballistic despite my best negotiation efforts. And I think we came very close to losing her, particularly possibly the child, and it's not unusual for a homicide to precede a suicide. So in order to keep them alive, I had to entice them outside to a helicopter where an FBI marksman was able to take his life, and we saved the woman and child. You know, and it was an interesting decision to make that the first chapter of my book. And when I worked with my literary agent, she asked me to write a sample chapter, and that's the chapter I wrote. And it's the chapter that sold it to Random House. And, because I only had an outline of other chapters. And so we felt we should start with that chapter because it's fairly dramatic and it's a pretty good story. But it also, I guess it was important for me to lay out the groundwork that I'm not some bleeding heart liberal that thinks, police should never use force or whatever like that. I mean, my son was a Navy SEAL. I mean, I've worked with the tactical teams. I'm not a, as they used to say, interior decorator, but I think it's important that, we follow through our firm belief that we use no more force than is absolutely necessary. So if we can use our communication skills, the most important thing we do is keep police officers safe. Of course, we want to save hostages and victims and perpetrators and stop people from killing suicide. All that's worthy goals. But the most important thing is that police officers go home to their families every night. And if I can keep them from having to go into a dangerous situation, then they're going to go home. Because the one thing we've learned is when good guys with guns confront bad guys with guns, bad things happen. And they don't just happen to the bad guys. You know, we've had hostages killed by the police. We've had police killed by the police. These are tense, dangerous, split-second decision kind of situations. And you just don't want to put officers in that if there's an alternative way to resolve it. So it's really not hard for me to embrace those concepts. I think they speak for themselves.
The chapter that completely engrossed me, of course, was the Waco, Texas case. So for those who maybe don't remember or weren't alive then, cult leader David Koresh and his flock called the Branch Davidians were confronted by something like 80 ATF agents. Something like that. And there's so many problems with this whole experience. And it starts with like how long it took you to get there. which I thought was really interesting, and the size of the room that they put you in. So it wasn't like the analysis of this was really interesting, because it was almost like in reflection, you're like, nope, from the beginning, there were missteps that led to, and there were some successes inside this process.
Yeah, we got 35 people out, including 21 children. I'm quite proud of that. But
that's a pretty big deal that people don't talk about.
No, they don't, because they remember the fire at the end, the Davidians starting the fire in response to the FBI putting tear gas in. But what really was the big problem at Waco, and almost everybody knows a little something about Waco, and it's the incident that just doesn't go away. It's a big historic event. But I think the big thing was the FBI had in 93 when this happened really departed from our longstanding philosophy. You know, people say, well, you just didn't know who you're dealing with a cult member. I said, no, we had a very good strategy and we understood him pretty well. It's the fact that on-scene managers for the FBI, while they were supportive of the negotiations, they were also supportive at the same time of very aggressive external tactical pressure, which as a negotiator, I know is what we call the paradox of power. The harder you push, the more likely you get resistance. And it sends a contrary message to that which the negotiators are sending. So while unintentional, we ended up sending very much mixed signals to David Koresh. Now, you know, at the end of the day, he's a cult leader. He's abusing his people. He's sexually abusing young underage girls, and he's the bad guy. But that doesn't then absolve the FBI from some poor management decisions. And that's the line I've always taken. It hasn't made me very popular in the FBI, I might tell you. But you know, and I'll tell you why as a little side note there. I mean, FBI agents are very proud. You know, when I became an FBI agent, I mean, it was an extraordinary proud moment in my life, and my generation was raised holding the FBI up on a pedestal. And, you know, and I think it's hard for agents who were attracted to the organization for those same reasons of pride and service and so forth to have to admit that things that we did, decisions we made, caused loss of life or contributed to loss of life is a hard pill to swallow. And so I think it's easier for those people to generally say, well, it doesn't matter what we did. The ending was inevitable. They were all going to die this way. So it makes it easier to remove culpability on our part. When reality is, again, Koresh is the bad guy. Gave him a chance to come out every day, encouraged him to, made all sorts of flexible arrangements to make him do that. But at the end of the day, he didn't do it. But that does not say that, you know, we go forward and crush cars in a very aggressive way that thwarted negotiations. That's not a proud moment for the FBI. And we moved away from that. You know, the on-scene commander was encouraged to retire, the tactical commander. I got a promotion. And, the FBI realized while it defended itself from external criticism, internally they knew they'd screwed up and it was not managed well. So after Waco, I ended up training every special agent in charge in the FBI. Here's the lessons learned from this. Here's what to do, what not to do. And the FBI's handled situations very effectively since, including 3 years later in Montana, we had an 85 or 81 day siege with an anti-government group called the Freeman. And in that instance, my team was allowed to devise the strategy and to lead the train, as it were. And everybody came out, no shots fired. Took a long time, but no reputational damage, no loss of life. Well worth the time and money.
It's interesting that, and I was thinking about that too with regard to time, because that like everyone is like, well, we've got to get going, and then you have to sort of start to go, well, why?
Yeah.
Why? And I'm curious, is there anything that you would have done differently at Waco to have affected the outcome, or was it just stacked against you from the beginning?
It kind of was. To give you a little bit of a backstory, I mentioned it in my book. Several years before Waco, we had a big prison riot in Talladega, and it did necessitate a tactical intervention. And the negotiators helped facilitate that, softening up the target, as it were, getting a hostage out that told us everything about what was going on and where everybody was held and so forth and so on. But ultimately, it had to be resolved through tactical intervention, and it was handled very well they explosively breached the prison, the hostage rescue team, that's our tactical team, and they rescued the hostages and regained control of the facility and reincarcerated all the inmates. Well, the head of the hostage rescue team at the time sort of came through that experience with really high stock value. I mean, the senior manager at the FBI said, oh, this is the guy that knows how to do this stuff. Fast forward a few years, we had the Ruby Ridge situation where I was not at, and the same person handled that very poorly, and yet was still on the job when Waco happened 6 months later. And I think he was given too much leeway, and that philosophy that he embraced to put tightening pressure to force people to do what we want, unfortunately got support by some people at FBI headquarters at the time. We had a very weak director then, William Sessions, and he kind of got rolled over. And the consequences were quite bad. You know, and then again, you fast forward to Montana, and Louis Freeh, now the director, says, Gary, are you there? Yes, sir. I'm in no rush for this to end. I want this to be resolved the right way. And that brought us back to where we had been before Waco, the way the FBI had operated and trained the whole world in how to do this stuff and had a stellar record in it. So, you know, for the record here with our podcast, I think Waco is more properly viewed as a departure from what we knew how to do and a tragic one. But that's kind of my take on it. But, you know, everybody has to be on the same sheet of music, you know, the tactical yeah. team, the negotiators, the news media people, the helicopter pilots that fly over, everybody to the best of their ability needs to convey the same consistent message. And if that is out of sync, it creates those internal problems that we started this conversation with of that's the negotiation within the negotiation. You know, I just tell my team at Waco, what you guys are doing, we're talking to David Koresh. That's child's complaint compared to what I'm doing. I have to negotiate with a crazy tactical team leader and a crazy on-scene commander. Far more challenging. So, yeah, I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek there, but there's some truth to that. And, you know, it's a shame because we knew to do better. There were religious scholars that said the FBI didn't understand Koresh's religion, and they should have brought us in to explain to him that his interpretation of the seven seals was not correct. Well, I just laugh at that then, and I laugh at it now. I mean, that's a fool's game, trying to convince somebody that they're – I mean, you take a room of 100 people, and 50 are pro-life and 50 are pro-choice, and you can present every argument in the world. The end of the evening, 50 will be pro-life and 50 will be pro-choice. You're not going to change people from their core beliefs, and to do so it's a waste of time and effort. We got 35 people out, as I mentioned, 21 children. And when we did that, we were focused on secular areas. We were not discussing religion when we're able to facilitate those releases. So that's my response to some of that.
I'm curious to get your take on this because we've probably done, I think, 6 of these different sessions. And we always lead this exercise called Thank You Because, which was developed out of work we did with the behavioral science community at the University of Chicago. And it's a way of – it's an exercise that speaks to how you can communicate through difference and keep that conversation going. And so we set up very low stakes. We're like low stakes disagreement, Pepsi versus Coke, beer versus wine, dogs versus cats. Like let's keep it on that level. And you're going to try to convince the other person you're right in the first round, which, of course, never succeeds. And the second round, we ask them to employ this technique of thank you because, which is before you respond to the person who's trying to convince you, you thank them for what they said. And the because is you just find something of value in what they said. It can be small. Yeah. It can be the tone of their voice. It doesn't matter. What always happens, so the bulk of the people get it. They're like, wow, that's an interesting technique for us to use with this. There is always, always one guy who's like, nope, didn't like it, refused to do it. And I'm like, why? And then they're like, no, I don't want to give it in. I'm like, you're arguing about Coke versus Pepsi. You can't see the need to be right on a Coke versus Pepsi. And they can't.
You know,
and I'm curious, does that surprise you?
Not at all. There's another example, you know, many times where I would be giving advice to a chief or sheriff. And, you know, we get these calls every week. There's some challenging situation somewhere around the country. And it was not being resolved as easily as they would like. So they'd call back and say, well, here's what's going on. And what do you think? Any ideas, any advice? And I would always say, you know, has the person really asked for anything? And sometimes they would say, yeah, he wants a Coke, you know, and, you know, and you'd say, well, I'd say, well, did you give it to him? And they'd say, well, no, what do we get for it? You know, as though this was I said, well, you know, the person's in there in crisis. They're considering killing their daughter and themselves. They're asking for a Coke. Do you think he did this today so he could get a Coca-Cola? I don't think so. You know, I think there's other things going on. And one of the things we need to try to do is establish a relationship, you know, that shows we're genuine. We want to help. We're not here to make his day worse. So a minor concession, you know, they used to say in negotiations, never give something unless you get something in return. That's great for 10% hostage taking quid pro quo bargaining, but that's not 90%+ of what we do. We're doing crisis intervention. And the real question to ask is not what we get. The question is, what do we lose? What do we lose? Mm-hmm. If I give this guy a cigarette, if I give him a Coke, what am I giving away? Nothing. Nothing. You know, but what might I gain from that? I might gain his perception that I'm a decent human being, that I'm not the typical cop that's just there to ruin his day and tell him what he better do and threaten him, to command him. I'm a human being. And I don't say I'm Officer so-and-so, Lieutenant, Special Agent, Gary, whatever. I just say, hey, this is Gary Kelly. I'm here to help you. And sounds like you're in a really difficult situation. And I'd like to help. And I know you're thirsty. Can I get you a soda in there? I mean, it's just the right human thing to do, and it doesn't hurt you a bit.
Yeah. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we end the podcast. But before we do that, can we talk about the DC sniper case?
Yeah, sure.
So I don't, for anyone who didn't live through this, the terror that sort of existed when this happened, and this is 2002. So, you know, already sort of a heightened time. And people started getting shot randomly, seemingly, yeah, in this area. And this is the area where, like, you live, right? I mean, this is your kids are out and about.
You know, I had two daughters that went to Mary Washington College in Fredericksburg. One of them had just left the Joann's fabric store before somebody was shot in the front of it. My other daughter used to routinely fill her car with gas at a gas station in that area where someone was shot. My son, the youngest, was his high school homecoming king, and they had to cancel the whole game and the parade and, you know, whatever focus was on that because they were scared of all outdoors events. You know, I'm not saying my family, you know, suffered tragic consequences, but it does hit close to home, you know, and
yeah,
and everybody in the metropolitan area. I mean, gas stations were putting up screens, you know, and there was all kind of speculation who was doing this. And, you know, it was quite a tense time in the Washington metropolitan area, both in Maryland and Northern Virginia.
And we talked about this before we jumped on the call that, this is when you called in Vince D'Alfonso, who is the guy who brought us into Quantico, who's yep, a Baltimore native, to the Joint Command Post. And so what was your approach to finding, because this, it seemed like there was no good clues for who this could be because it was so random.
Yeah. To suggest that negotiations was a key element there, you know, it would be an overstatement, but there are two things that we did. Number one was we prepared that if we did speak, if the snipers did call in, that we would be prepared to have a dialogue with them. And that one call mm-hmm. did come in. They just jumped off of it right quick. It didn't, yeah, it didn't come to anything. The other thing we did as negotiators, and yeah, Vince was from the Baltimore area, and he worked for me in the crisis negotiation unit. So I sent him up there. I went up as well, but he was there for the bulk of the time to be our negotiation representative in the Joint Command Post, and he did a great job. The one thing that we tried to do was influence the public statements that the police made. And you may know the story, I'll share it with our viewers, that at one point in time, after they killed somebody, they the snipers left a note. We didn't know it was a they then, but a note was left saying, "I want you to say that you caught the sniper like a duck in the noose." Now, what the hell does that mean? You know, we didn't know. And my negotiation team and I said, we need to make a comment about that. And the one time in my career where some FBI profilers disagreed with us, they said, "You're going to empower them." And my view was, well, I think they feel pretty empowered. They're shooting one person after another. I said, I think we have to address this, because I know in negotiations, whether something seems important to us or not, if it's important to the other person, we have to address it. So we prepared a press statement that said Chief Moose was going to say, "You've asked us to say that we caught the sniper like a duck in the noose. We don't know why you want us to say that, but it's important to you, and in our hopes of preventing you from taking any more innocent lives, we are making that statement right now." It's perfect. The public understands why you're saying it. You address the bad guys. Well, we were all ready to go with that, and at the last minute, one of the FBI commanders got swayed by an FBI profiler and nixed it, and they killed somebody the next day. And they said, "You're not doing what we told you to do." And I think that was a preventable death and a bad decision. But it goes back to this: what do we get for it? You know, again, what do you lose? What do you lose? And I think that's a mindset that is a male law enforcement military mindset. It's a power thing. You know, we don't like it when people are forcing our hand to do something that we're really not comfortable with. But sometimes we have to say, hey, you know, let's be flexible. Let's be creative. Let's think outside the box and do something different. And I think that's the way to go in a lot of cases.
So we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, we know that when you're making something out of nothing, saying no doesn't get you anywhere. And yes actually doesn't do that much work. We say yes and, which is really about exploring and heightening the thing that's in front of you. And I feel like this should be a layup for you based on reading all the different stories in the book, but I'm wondering what comes to your mind when you think of a yes and story from your work in your life.
A yes and story. You know, and I think you said before, it's something that we really didn't want to do, but we had to do anyway. Yeah. You know, during the Montana siege, we finally had near 60-something days into it beyond, we finally were able to entice one of the Freeman leaders to come out and meet with us. And I met with him, another FBI agent, myself, we met with him. And in that conversation, he was a genuinely likable guy that had kind of made some bad decisions. And in that discussion, you know, we said, "Edwin, it's time to lead everyone out safely." And he said, "I've got a request." And we said, "Okay, what is it?" He said, "I want to meet with Leroy Schweitzer." Now, he was the head of the Freeman who we had arrested on the first day of the siege, started the siege. So he's asking us to fly him from the siege to Billings, Montana, to meet with a leader in the jail and let him go back into the siege. And it's never been, you know, total without precedent, you know, no historical examples of this, never been done, quite risky. From political disclosure and so forth. And later on, he killed somebody or whatever. You'd say, well, you had him in your custody and you let him go. But, you know, I finally said, yes, we can do that, you know, and I didn't want to. I was hoping I could just convince him to step up to the plate. But I made that decision by saying, "Edwin, what are you going to do if you meet with Leroy and he says, don't surrender yet?" I said, "What are you going to do? What will your response be?" And he looked at me in the eyes and he said, "I guess I'll just have to make the best decision I can after that." I interpreted that unambiguously to mean he was coming out regardless, but he was looking for that stamp of approval. So for me, that was the factor that led me to suggest we take this risk. And it worked. It worked. We flew him out surreptitiously, took him to Billings. He met with Leroy, and Leroy gave him permission to surrender. And he was then enthusiastic about doing it because he didn't feel guilty about betraying the Freeman's core beliefs, their anti-government beliefs. So I'm not sure if that's an example of what you had in mind, but, you know, it is a no that had to be turned into a yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly, because you don't know what's going to happen when you do it. But until you do it, you're kind of just stuck where you are. And there's another, a couple other phrases that we say in our work that seems to resonate with these audiences, that we see all obstacles as gifts and we learn to make mistakes work for you. And I think this idea, even with Waco, look, failure, but you rarely learn from the successes. So hopefully what you do is you learn from the failures.
Well, I think that's right.
And that requires being really honest and having some sense of self-awareness and appreciation for a variety of viewpoints and different ways that you got there.
The example I showed you with taking Edwin to meet with them, there were certainly some challenges with the optics, but my thinking was, okay, let's say he flies out. He meets with Schweitzer. Schweitzer says, stay the course, don't surrender. Edwin goes back in. Are we any worse off? Have we really lost anything of substance? No. And that's how I explain it. Again, the right question is not what we gain, what do we lose? And we don't really lose anything. So is it worth the effort to try? And I would say absolutely. And it's amazing how many times that embracing that approach does not get embraced because of that initial instinctive reluctance to do anything until you've gotten some ironclad promise that somebody will definitely do something else. But it's like the Moonies. Remember the Moonies at the airports? They'd walk up to you and give you a flower. What would you do? You give them a buck. It's reciprocity. Edwin, I did this for you. Now, what are you going to do for me? It's basic human, Dr. Cialdini talks a great deal about, influence skills. And that's one of them, but I think we get from people what we give them. And if we come across as likable, that's the number one negotiation attribute, Kelly, likability, just plain old, unadulterated, all-American, vanilla likability. What is about that guy you like? I don't know, but I like him. Just a nice person. I just enjoyed hanging around them, hearing their stories. They seem very nice. Not an obnoxious, inappropriate thing about them. Well, that's currency. That has a lot of value to be that likable person, even if you can't define what it is that you find likable. So, that's the earmark for a good negotiator, a good interpersonal communicator.
Everyone should read this book. It's called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. Gary Noesner, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure, Kelly.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com. Or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.